I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker for the month of May, speaking on steps 3, 4, and 5, and that will be Jean from Seeker.
Hey, everybody. My name is Jean, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Before I even get into this, you all need to know that I don't do this well. I do my story half well. I like to believe really and honestly that I walk the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a really tough time talking them. I just really do. So it's. I had to make myself some notes. I apologize for that, but I had to do it. My notes are from my own notes in my big book. That's a little tattered and torn and a little worse for wear, but that's okay. It's my security blanket. And before I even get into talking about steps 3, 4, and 5, I just have a couple little things that I'd like to share. Monday was a real important day in my life. It was 20 years ago on Monday that I had my last drink. And that is a miracle in my life. Truly is. It's a miracle in my life. And I don't know if this happens to anybody else when they get near their anniversary or birthday or whatever you want to call it. I still get confused, you know. It's an anniversary in the North. It's a birthday in the South. And it is what it is, I guess. And I don't know. Maybe it doesn't affect men as much as it does women. And maybe it doesn't affect all women the way it affects me. But my emotions were real close to the surface on Monday. Very, very close to the surface. And I did a couple of things that I do almost every year because it's important for me to be reminded of where I am in my own sobriety. And the first thing I did was I called my sponsor in Point Pleasant at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I said good morning, and I told her that today it's 20 years, and she said to me, it is not. And I said, yes, it is. And we started to reminisce, and we started to talk about, you know, my early sobriety and where I am today. And then when I got to work, I made two more very important phone calls. First, I called the only counselor that's left at Alena Lodge that was there when I walked across the parking lot as a really sick person some 20 years ago. And he still, every anniversary that he leads for me, he still tells the entire group assembled what a miserable, ugly which I was, and I love him for it. So I called, and I didn't get him, but I did get an answering machine, and I left him a message, and I told him that he needed to know how important he was in my life, and how important Alena Lodge is in my life, because it was there that I learned how to finally knock down some of those walls that I had built up for so very, very long, and I think I shared a little bit about that last week. And then last but not least, of course, I had to call my sponsor in Charleston. You know, I shared last week, I can't give up either of them. You know, I'm afraid that if I give one of them up, that might be the one thing that might be keeping me sober. The same as I'm afraid to give up any of the meetings that I go to, because I don't know which meeting it is that's helping me to stay sober. I'm afraid to not to hit my knees every morning, because that might be the ticket, you know. That just might be the thing. So all of these things that I've become accustomed to using all these this time that I've been privileged to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm afraid not to continue on doing that, so I had to call her, got her answering machine, you know, and I left a message to her, but I got a very nice card from her today, and it just made me feel really, really good. And then the other thing that I need to share from the podium, because I think if I share it from here, I know I'll be heard up there. And I lost a real dear friend Tuesday morning. I had the privilege, and it was a real privilege, to have a man by the name of Cornel Foy in my life. I met Cornel when I first moved to Myrtle Beach in 1988. And I don't even know how old or how sober he was at that time. I'd have to use math, and I don't add, subtract, multiply, or divide. But I know that I don't balance a checkbook either, so you know what kind of trouble I'm in. But Cornel died Tuesday morning at the age of 93 with 53 years of sobriety. And like I read from my thing last week from Tom Chase in Tennessee, Cornel was another one of those who every time he saw me would tell me how much he loved me. And I could sit and I could listen to that man for hours. I could just sit and listen. He talked about early sobriety in South Carolina and Georgia. When he got sober, however long ago 53 years is, I don't know. But anyway, when he got sober, he lived in Savannah, Georgia. And there were some people who lived in Statesboro, Georgia by the name of Dr. John and Dot Mooney and C.D. and Ida Collins. And they were all in early sobriety. And they would drive from Statesboro, Georgia to Savannah and pick up Cornel. And then they would drive to Walterboro, South Carolina, and they would pick up Miss Ruby Hamilton and her husband. Miss Ruby just celebrated 50 years. And then they might go on up to Florence. Now, in distance in New Jersey, I'm trying to think, it's probably like driving from the Delaware Memorial Bridge all the way up to Blairstown. I mean, that's about how far they went in those years just to get a meeting. And Cornel would talk about, and he'd listen to people today and analyze and do all of this, and he would say, why do they want to complicate it? Why do they want to complicate it? It is so simple. And he was a big influence in my life. He left a fabulous legacy, and I know he's up there, and I know he's running the next meeting. I know that. I know that for a fact. I know he's where he's supposed to be. They're going to have a memorial service for him on Sunday at the Alano Club in Myrtle Beach. Unfortunately, I can't quite get there. I wish I could. But my thoughts will be there, and it was just a privilege to know him. So I had an up and a down again this week, you know, one of those things. And I've hopefully learned how to balance things out a little bit. Last week when I shared my story and parts of 1 and 2 about my powerlessness, which was obvious, I think, if you listen to it. I mean, I had no power whatsoever. And the things that I did, you know, I used to say I woke up in bedrooms and boardrooms in places that I didn't belong, and that was very true. And then step 2, which was believing that there was a power that was greater than myself and was not myself, that could restore me to some type of sanity. And, you know, unfortunately, for a long time, I thought about sanity as, you know, you were either insane or sane. If you were insane, you were in Marlboro, and Marlboro's down there now because I'm in the wrong part of the state. and if you were sane, you were walking around. And it took me a long time to understand what the insanity in my life was. And when I was really able to take a really good look at it, I did believe that there was a power that was greater than me that could restore me to sanity. And now we get to step 3. Anything that I say is my own opinion. That's been announced already before. And anything I say is really probably not novel. It's nothing I made up. It's something I heard somebody share at some point in time that made an impact on me and made me remember it. For me, steps 1, 2, and 3 are the giving up steps. You know, I am giving up. I am giving up my power. I am hopefully giving up some unmanageability. And I'm hopefully giving up my insanity to get some sanity. The principle of step 3 for me is faith. You know, once I am able to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God as I understand him, it's faith. I have to develop the faith in my life to be able to do that. Once I've been able to do that, for me, I find that it gives me courage. It gives me the courage to continue on this journey in steps 4 through 12. So I heard somebody say once that if my will was action and my life was action and my will was thinking, then all I'm doing is turning my thinking and my actions over to somebody else. That's all I'm doing. You know, it doesn't say that I give up my independence. It doesn't say that I can't continue to go and do the things that I've been doing. It just says that I can no longer be the power in my life. I cannot do that. I met a fellow quite a few years ago up at a little conference I used to go to up in the Chattahoochee Forest up in the mountains of Georgia, named Freddie Morton. I don't even care if I break his anonymity at this point. And I don't, you know. I break mine all the time. And but Freddie had a wonderful analogy. You know, a lot of things that I do and I get from the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is an analogy. It's picturing it a different way. And Freddie used to say that turning your will and your life over to the care of God was like hiring a babysitter to take care of your children when you're going out. And that makes a lot of sense to me. When my children were younger and my husband and I wanted to go out to dinner, I hired a babysitter. I asked a babysitter to come into my house, and I asked this babysitter to take care of my children because I was incapable of watching and taking care of my children at that moment. I was incapable of doing that. I was not available. So for me, if I turn my will and my, if I picture God as my babysitter for my life, then all I do is I turn my will and my life over to the babysitter because I am not capable of handling it. Made a lot of sense to me. That I understand. That I cannot, I don't know how to analyze all of this, and I'm not a student. I'm really not. I'm not a student of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and the big book and the 12 steps. I live these steps. I practice them in my life. When I had a problem, this story came to my mind, and then I knew I had a general idea on how I could do that. Also, for me, one of the things that I do with the problems in my life that I need to turn over to this higher power of mine, who I honestly can tell you is my relationship with God has certainly changed over all the years. And when I first got sober, I had this relationship, but nothing compared to what I have now. And I have, right now I have a real God box. I mean, I have a real, honest God box. It was given to me by a very dear friend of mine, and it's teak, and it's about this big, and it says, Gene's God Box. Now, before I got my God Box, I had an old shoebox that I used, and then I had an old pocketbook that I used for a while. It's a beautiful pocketbook. Actually, it's wooden, and it's shaped about like this, and I used to take sticky notes, and I would write down all of these things that I just was... I would find that many times in my sobriety has not been an easy journey. And I would find many times that there were incidents and situations over which I had no control, but I, of course, was trying to take control. And, yeah, because I have always felt that I could do it better than anybody. You know, if you would just turn it over to me, I would handle it. But unfortunately, I can't do that in many, many instances. So I do use my God box, and I would take these sticky notes, and I would write whatever it was, and I would put it into my God box, and then I would put the God box away on a shelf in my closet. And there was something about doing that that allowed me to turn it over, to turn that part of my life over. I remember... last week I did share, and I will share more, because some good did come out of when I was about 4 years sober, I guess, I went and got married. I had been divorced. My first husband had divorced me as a result of my alcoholism. I was no longer welcome in my home. I had no place to go. Rehab was a good idea, so I went there and stayed as long as I could. And I shared last week that no member of my family came out of the closet, you know, and said, cute little thing, you know. You quit drinking, why don't you come live with me? You know, nobody offered to do that either, so I was kind of up the creek without a paddle. I was 45 years old. I had no home. I was going to have to go to work. I'd never held a job in my life. And things were not very good. And that was really where I first learned how to turn my will and my life over to a care of God, because I knew I had no control over this. And I knew whatever God had in store for me would be fine if I would just believe. And but when I was about, I think I was about 4 years sober, maybe 3.5 or 4, I got this brilliant idea that I would get married. And it was not a good choice. There were some people who did try to talk me out of it, and because I'm so hard-headed and I still have a lot of self-will, I didn't listen. And about 7 years down the road from that, when I was 10 years sober, I went through a second surrender that where I truly had to surrender anything and everything that I had under the care of this God that had brought me that far, because I could not anymore. The pain was so bad at that point in time in my life that I really believed I was going to die. The miracle of the whole thing was I never thought about a drink. I mean, that was just amazing to me. The thought of a drink never came through my head. But I was financially destitute. I was about to lose my home. I was working a good job. I was working 6 days a week. But I just couldn't do it all by myself, and I had been left in that position where I had to do it. So I remember then, every night I would sit down. I mean, this wasn't a one-shot deal for the God Box, folks. This was every night I sat down, and because I could not obsess over it anymore. And every night I would write whatever it was. I needed to sell my house. My house wouldn't sell. You know, I needed to get on with my life. I needed to get a divorce. This man wanted anything and everything I had or had ever had, and plus a little bit more that maybe I didn't have. And I just wasn't willing, you know, to give up all of that stuff. And I needed guidance and direction. And so every night I wrote a note to the God Box. And every night I opened it up, I put the note in. What was so wonderful about my God Box was that about once a year I go and I clean it out. You know, and I open it up, and it's absolutely amazing to me. Whatever things I have turned over to the God of my understanding that have taken care of themselves, just taken care of themselves. And so step three for me is a really, really very important step, and it's something that I need to do. I need to do it every day. I need to do it every morning when I hit my knees. And I'll talk about hitting my knees probably later, but I will tell you that for this old lady, it's very difficult to hit your knees. So what I do is I roll out of bed. I roll. It's not a pretty sight, folks. But I roll because I know if my feet hit the floor, there's no way I'm going to hit my knees. You know, osteoarthritis has taken over. And so it's just easier for me before I start moving in the day that I roll over. And I roll down and my knees hit the floor, and then, you know, I do that third step one more time, and I just thank God for this day. And I ask God to please allow me to stay away from a drink one day at a time, you know, just for today. And to do with me as He can do with me. To use me for whatever purpose it may be that God has in store for me. I don't know what that purpose is, but I do know that God does take care of, He takes care of drunks and children, and He's taken really good care of me. And I also, a friend of mine said a long time ago that it's a good thing that I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, because at least then it's not in the hands of an idiot. And I think that's probably very true. I mean, look where it got me to begin with when I was 45 years old, you know. I tried doing that for all of those years. And that's all that there is to it. My sponsor, Jean, in South Carolina, also has said that a lot of people have, because I think we feel that we're just giving up our lives, you know, we're just giving up everything that we are. And for me, that is not true. You know, I'm just turning something over because I can't do it. But she has always said, and I have it written in my, I can't remember which book it is it's written in, whether it's my step book or my big book, I honestly don't, that the power of God is not controlling. power of God is sustaining. You know, it allows me to do what I do today. If I didn't have a belief in a higher power, I truly do not know where I would be today. You know, this has sustained me through the death of my first husband when he dropped dead, which was a traumatic time for all of us, through a rotten second marriage that almost killed me. God has carried me. You know, it always takes me back to footprints. You know, why? You know, that last line, you know? God, you know, didn't leave me. God carried me. But God carries me, I believe, by putting different people in my life. He does. He puts certain people in my life at a time when I need it. And it may not be the time when I think that they should be in my life, but they're there. And I learn, and I sometimes don't even know why they're there till they've left. You know, until they've left. And my second husband is a very good example of that. God put that man in my life. We got married. It was not good. I remember waking up one morning, looking in my mirror. I have a sign on my bathroom mirror, no matter where I live, it's there. I do them now on labels. And it says, you are looking at the problem. Well, I also know that if I'm looking at the problem in that mirror, I'm looking at the solution. You know, and that's what happened to me that morning. And I looked and I said, I didn't get sober to be this miserable. I want to be miserable. I can go drink. And that was when I made the decision that there had to be some changes in my life. But as I look back, that man was put in my life for a reason. I believe today, first of all, I stopped smoking when I was married to him because he asked me to. And I'm more than grateful to him for that. He introduced me to my favorite Italian restaurant ever, which I love, you know, so there was a purpose in that. And he decided to move to South Carolina. I never would have done that. You know, I would have stayed around my family and plodded through, hating the weather and whatever. And I had 11 marvelous years in South Carolina, had a lot of people come into my life in that time who are still in my life today. So there are lessons. You know, I look back and I know that God puts these people in my life at a time when I need them. And I sometimes don't know the lesson until I'm way down the road and I look back and I see how come and I see why. Step three for me is just a marvelous, marvelous step. It allows me to put things up on the shelf, turn it over to a power that's greater than me, and watch for the miracles. That's what step three allows me to do. And as I said, when I started this tirade or whatever it is, this pontificating that I'm doing, it gives me courage. That, for me, that's one of the things that comes out of the third step is the courage. And in order to do the fourth step, I needed courage. I really needed courage. I am still of the belief that you take more than one fourth and fifth step. I believe that. Not everybody does. They believe you take a fourth and a fifth step, and then, you know, the rest of it is all handled by the tenth step. I know how sick I was. I really do. I know how sick I was. And I know that how much stuff I had crammed all the way down. It was crammed down so far that it was not going to come out right away. And I knew that. And I was told that when I was sitting up there at Alina Lodge. While I was there at the lodge, they do ask you, first thing you do when you go to the lodge, at least when I went, I can't talk about it now because it's changed. What you go is you write your story. You write your life story, and you go back as far as you can remember, and then work forward as far back as you can remember. I can remember back to about 5. That's about as far back as I can go, and those are bits and pieces. And when you write your life story, you're told to write and leave the margins really wide, because when you're, and it's only for you. Nobody else is going to read it, which was wonderful. That was a relief for me. I sure did not want anybody reading my garbage, because I did some really ugly things in my lifetime. And you're told to leave these margins really, really wide, and then you go back and you reread your life story, and you can pretty much, at least I could, pick out some of the character defects that were absolutely glaring. Absolutely glaring. My selfishness and my self-centeredness was there. But what I had never realized was there that was so glaring was my arrogance. You know, my arrogance. And what I know today, I did not know this when I did my first step, but I know it today, and I've probably only realized it in maybe the last year or so, is that my arrogance was based on fear. You know? You back me into a corner, and you start at me, and I really get scared. And so, but rather than let you know that I'm scared or that I am fear-based, then I'm going to get as arrogant as can be, because the more arrogant I am, the farther away you're going to stay, and you won't come in here. You know, and I couldn't let you in. I could not do that. So the very first thing I did back whenever that was I wrote my life story. I still have it. It's horrible. It's horrible. I mean, some of the things that were so fresh in my memory, I mean, thank God. Mrs. Delaney always used to say that God gives us a good forgetter. And I am really, really grateful that God gives me a good forgetter. Because periodically, when I need a real jolt into reality, I go pull that sucker out. Now, I have been advised by Greg Varley, for one, and Alina Lodge, to go and either burn it or hide it. Because when I die, when you die, Gene, you do not want your children to find that. Well, I didn't die yet, and I didn't burn it. But, you know, I'm thinking about it. Maybe it's probably not a bad idea. But I do. I go back periodically, and I read this. And a lot of my antics is a very good word. My antics in my late alcoholism prior to getting sober were very real in my mind, what little bit I could remember. And so I wrote all of that stuff down, and I go back now. And you know how we talk about crossing over that line from problem drinking into, you know, alcoholism? We talk about that. Somewhere along the line in my sobriety, for me, I don't know if anybody else has ever experienced this, I have crossed over another line. The line I've crossed over is that when I talk about my act of alcoholism and the woman that I was, I swear to you, I do not know her. I do not know her. It's like I am out, it's like an out-of-body experience. I mean, I talk about the things that I did, and for some reason, it is just so horrendous to me. Some of the things that, the acts that I did, the people that I hurt, the arrogance and the selfishness and the self-centeredness, and I know I'm not like that today, so I have a hard time relating to this person that was back there. Very difficult for me. But I go back and I read it. So now I've done my story and I've got this stuff, and at Alina Lodge, what we had to do was we had to write down our character defects and go to Webster's Dictionary and look up the meaning. So I went and I looked up the meaning. And I wrote down what the meaning of the word was, all my selfishness, self-centeredness, arrogance, impatience, intolerance, immaturity. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on. And then we were advised, or it was suggested, that's a really good word too, it was suggested that we write a line or two about how that particular defect played a part in our own lives. So that was my very first fourth step that I ever, ever did. It was the very best that I was capable of doing at the time. Absolutely the best. I could not have done a better fourth step. I hear people talk about, well, my first fourth step wasn't very good. I didn't feel that way about my first fourth step. What I felt about my fourth step was I was where I was. I did what I could do. There it was. And that's all that I was capable of getting out at that moment. So because of that, I know over the years I've taken four or five fourth and fifth steps. I have done fourth and fifth step on one particular issue. I found that was necessary for me. And it all relates back to my horrible, you know, my bad marriage. My bad marriage. I had to do it. That was the only way I could get rid of the resentment and the anger and all the other stuff that went with it. I knew no other way to do it. So then I did this, and then I got out of Alena Lodge. I was allowed to leave. I didn't think I was ever going to leave, but I was allowed to leave, and I left on September the 25th, 1983. And I came home, and I remember that just prior to Christmas, I had at that point been divorced, because he got me for a few things, you know. He didn't have to wait any 18 months like you do in New Jersey. Trust me, he didn't have to wait. He had his laundry list. And I remember thinking that just prior to Christmas that maybe it might not be a bad idea if I did a fifth step. So I did my very first fifth step. Was it the best fifth step in the world? It was the best I could do. It was the very best I could do at the time for where I was. Unlike a lot of people who have... I was going to say not as much time, but that just sounds so arrogant. That's not what I'm trying to say. I have always, for me, taken my fifth step with my parish priest. I have just always done that. I have two sponsors. They know anything and everything that there is to know about. I've probably taken fifth steps with them and don't even know that I've done it. But I've never taken a formal fifth step with either of them. This is just for me. It's where I am most comfortable, and in the book it tells us, you know, that you should pick someone with whom you are comfortable. It says, pick a minister, pick a doctor, pick, you know, another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever. I had a wonderful priest when I first got out of rehab and at my little Episcopal church, which is literally around the corner from my house in Seagirt, you know, because Seagirt is so big, I told you last week how big it is, you know. 11 blocks north to south, 9 blocks east to west. Can't get lost. You know, and I could walk around the corner there if I wanted to. And I remember I called Father Hulbert and I asked him, you know, and he was familiar with alcoholism. And what was even more interesting was he was familiar with seeing me as the town drunk. So, and he was very willing to have me come, and he was very willing to have me sit down with him. And was it the best ever? Probably not. But I did feel relief when I walked out of there. I did feel like I had bared as much as I could bear and as much as I was capable of bearing. This next time that I got around to doing a fourth step inventory, I really did. At that point, I had already gone to one Joe and Charlie. I'd gone to two. I lie. Harold and I were living in South Carolina, and we had gone to a Joe and Charlie Big Book study in Raleigh, which just blew my mind, because I can't honestly tell you that until that point that I had really delved into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been to Big Book studies and whatever, but I'd never had it gone through so thoroughly, where I sat with my marker and just kept marking and writing and marking and writing and whatever. And then... there was a friend of ours there who did a lot of taping. He's long retired now. And Bob Paulk came up to us and said, Joe and Charlie had just had a cancellation and they had an open weekend. And would we like to do a Big Book study in Charleston? And, of course, we jumped at the opportunity and we put one together in about 3 months, I think it was. We didn't have much time to think about it, but we just got going and we did. And we found a place and Joe and Charlie came and we had Mrs. Delaney come down from Blairstown and be our Saturday night speaker, and she blew my mind because she sat in on the sessions with Joe and Charlie, and she brought her pad and her pencil with her, and she took notes. The woman was 40-some, almost 50 years sober, you know. Taught me a lesson, you know. You know, I can always learn something. I can always, always learn. And I do learn. I learn to this day. I go to a Big Book study every Tuesday night. And I went to a Big Book study, and we're almost like the third or fourth page before the end of the chapter to the agnostic. And And I had my highlighter out. And I was underlining stuff that I swear to you I never saw. And I never saw it on that page. You know, and I said, thank you, God. And because I'm still teachable. And things are popping out. And it's all dependent upon where I am in my own recovery. Where I am in my recovery. And that night I was supposed to talked about change on that particular page and how change comes. And, you know, and Bob Bazance always says that the change is not difficult. Resistance to change is difficult. You know, and I love that. I love that. I like to quote him all the time. I forgot to tell Billy's story. Did you tell your story when you were here? My favorite story. No, he didn't. About God doesn't row? Oh, I'm going to tell God doesn't row. Well, I got lost, but I do that. You know, I'm old and I'm allowed to do that. I first met Bill probably about 6 or 7 years ago now, back down in Charleston. When I listened to him, so I was at a young people's conference, and I don't want to hear about it. I was at a young people's conference. It was wonderful, and he was I can't even remember, for Saturday night speaker, I don't even remember. But he tells this wonderful story about this whole thing, this recovery thing, you know, is a partnership. I row, God steers. That's just the way it works. I row, God steers. But there comes that point in time in my journey when I say to God, you know, God, I'm really tired of rowing. What I'd like to do is I'd like to steer. And God says, go right ahead. Just remember, I don't row. And that is my favorite story. And every time I see him someplace, I ask him to remember to tell it. Because it is my favorite story. It just sort of sums the whole thing up. I tell the girls that I sponsor, you know, when they start telling me they want to do this or they want to do that, I tell them that's just fine and dandy. But just remember, God doesn't row. You know, if you think you can do it, you know, that's fine. But God does not row. Anyway, I got distracted again. So now we've done these two big book studies and so now today when I do my fourth step, I do use the sheets. I don't know how thorough I am, but I'm as thorough as I can possibly be, you know, and I make a list of all my resentments and my fears and then I go across and I find out. For me, the most important part of the whole thing is what was my part? What was my part? For so long I wanted to go like this. You know, it was always somebody else's fault. You know, if my mother hadn't been a daily drunk, if my father hadn't been a periodic, if my brothers hadn't tortured me, you know, if my first husband hadn't, if my second husband hadn't, if whatever, 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 whatever. But you know what? I had a part in it. And a lot of times I have the girls that I sponsor say, well, I didn't do anything. You know what? Maybe I didn't do anything, and maybe they didn't do anything, but I was in a place at a certain time when I shouldn't have been there. You know, so that's my part. You know, I have to look at my part. What did I do? I have a really good relationship today with my youngest daughter. I have an iffy relationship with my oldest daughter, and that's okay today. That's okay. My children are exactly where they were in their recovery the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. My children have never had a program. You know, I was the problem, and if I got better, then that would be fine. And unfortunately, fortunately, I did, and they didn't. You know, and I see all of the character defects. I move Saturday. That's the other reason my life is in a turmoil right now. I had to rent my house for the summer again because I need a new roof. And that's the only way you get a new roof. When you own a house in Seagirt, you rent it for the summer and you move. And you move in with your oldest daughter that you've got this relationship with. So if you don't think I'm not going to be practicing the third step and doing a lot of inventory taking, folks, And she was supposed to be in Brussels, Belgium, living until September, and she told me today she's not going back for a couple of weeks. So we'll see. We did it last summer, and we survived, but, you know, it's... Anyway, today, it's hard. It's just very hard for this alcoholic to do that. I'm very independent. I've lived alone for a long time. I've been single longer than I've ever been married, and it's just hard for me. I'm set in my ways, and to give up my space is very difficult, you know, but I have to do that. And I couldn't do it if I didn't have the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't. It would be impossible. Anyway, I have to, now today I just use, I use that, you know, I use the sheets, and I do, and I go through, and I look at my part, you know, and as I say, sometimes I've had to, I've done a very thorough one, I've done it all the way through, I've gone to my parish priest, I've been relieved, and it's been really good. I can tell you about the best fifth step I ever did, and I can tell you about the worst. And I tell it because it's a sign and a signal to all of us. I learned, as I said, you know, everything that comes out of my mouth is a lesson for me, somewhere along the line, and I learned the lesson. When I was living in Charleston, I was about 8 years sober, I guess. And I decided it was time for another thorough house cleaning. Because, as I said, you know, I had a lot of stuff was slowly starting to emerge that I just wasn't even aware of. And these were things that I needed to take care of. If I want to lead a sober life, I have to take care of it. I have to clean house. I have to do it. I can't move forward until I clean this house. And so I went and I did it, and I did it as best I possibly could, and I called my priest, and he was a wonderful, wonderful man, Father Clark. And I called Father Clark, and I asked him if I could have an appointment. I wanted to come and do a fifth step. And do you know what a fifth step is? You know. And he said, oh, Gene, I'm very familiar. He said, my father was an alcoholic. I have a big book in my office. I have, you know, been to Al-Anon, whatever. Okay. So I knew that he knew. And I have to tell you, it was such a wonderful experience because he knew. And I went in and I sat down, and I remember he sat in front of me and he leaned forward and he took my hands and he said, before we start this, we're going to pray. And we did. And then I spilled my gut and I went through my fourth step, and I, you know, talked about this arrogance that was still there, although not as blatant as it had been, and my selfishness and other things, that self-centeredness, my ego. And then when I was finished, he almost went through the sixth step with me. He said, we will pray again. And he took my hands and we prayed. And he prayed for peace for me. And then he kissed me goodbye, and I left. And how cool was that? You know, that was just, it was marvelous. It was such a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And then I went and I did the next fourth step I did. I was 10 years sober. I was in the middle of this horrible, horrendous mess. My kids were sending me money. My brother was saving my house for me. The house wouldn't sell. I even went and bought, I'm not even Catholic, I went and bought one of those statues of St. Joe, somebody. One of those saints I was supposed to buy and bury him in my garden upside down, you know. And the great thing was that when I sold my house, I went to dig him up and I couldn't find him. You know, so he's still in there, you know. I don't know if the other people that bought my house, you know. But he's still there. I did look for him because then they said you're supposed to dig him up and take him to your new place. And I couldn't find him. He got lost somewhere. He got lost. So anyway, I went and as I say, I was having this really tough time, and so I did I decided that what I had to do, because I was fear and anger and about, and I was blaming myself, which I think a lot of us tend to do. How could I have been so stupid? Why did I knew better. Why did I do this? I had, in the year before, 2 years before that, my eighth year or so, I had received a very nice inheritance from my father's estate, and that managed to disappear too, which is why I'm still working today. And it was my own fault. I can't blame him, although he went through it, but I allowed it. You know, I allowed it, and I was madder. I was so angry with myself. And I just didn't understand. So I sat down. I said, the only way I know how to do this is to do a fourth and a fifth step. It's the only thing I know. It is just absolutely eating me alive, and it's killing me. It was killing me. Now, the only thing I wasn't doing was I wasn't drinking. That's about the only thing I wasn't doing. And so I sat down, and I wrote this whole thing out, and I got it all out on paper. And sometimes for me that is a big help. That is a really big help. When I have things that really bother me, I sometimes will sit down and I'll write it all out, and I fold the piece of paper up and I stick it in a drawer, and the next day I go and I haul it out because I want to see how important was it. You know, usually by the next day it's gone, and then I'm not as angry as I was or upset or whatever. And I have the girls that I sponsor, I do that with them too. They'll call me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I had one girl call me at 2 o'clock in the morning obsessing over a man. You know, I said to her, Fran, for God's sake, just write it out. Put it in a drawer. Call me at noon tomorrow. We'll talk about how important it is. You know, I never did hear from her about that. A couple days later, I saw her at a meeting. I asked her how important it was that she had to wake me at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know. Oh, it wasn't. Oh, Gene, I just sat down. I wrote it all out. You know what? I put it in that drawer. I pulled it out. It was fine. Hello, you know. Anyway, I wrote this whole thing out, and I wrote about my frustration. I was so angry with myself. I was really beaten up on myself. And we had a new priest. And I thought, well, this is what I'll do. I've always done this before, and I will call him up, and I'll make an appointment. I'll go down, and I'll take this fifth step. And it'll be a really good opportunity for me to get to know him and for him to get to know me. So I called him up. You know, I'm so grateful. I can't even remember that man's name. So I called him up, and I asked to make an appointment. I called the church. And I asked, you know, if I could please come and have an appointment, whatever. Yes, I could. And I asked him if he knew anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, because otherwise I was willing to take my step book and, you know, lend him my step book so he could read 4 and 5 and, you know, have a general idea of what it was I was trying to accomplish. Oh, no, he says, I think there's one hanging around here. I said, okay, fine, whatever. So I went, and And this particular fourth and fifth step was on these results, my former husband. And, well, he wasn't then, he was still my husband. And this man listened, and then he looked me square in the eye, and he said, "You are very sick. I really think you need some therapy. I want to know why you always pick the wrong man." And I thought, where in all of this that I was talking about myself and my anger and my resentment and whatever, where did this come out? I picked the wrong man? There was nothing wrong with my first husband. I mean, he was a saint as I look back for the nonsense that he put up with for 24 years. You know? And it was a mistake. We all make mistakes. I made a mistake. That's all. But it helped me in that I got it all out. But I remember leaving and going back to my office. I'm a paralegal by profession, and I was the lead paralegal on the breast implant litigation, which was very big quite a few years ago. I think it's winding down now, and I had 850 cases for myself and 7,000 in the office or something. Anyway, and I remember going back to my office, and I remember calling my sponsor, and I was hysterical. I said to her, am I really as sick as this man says I'm sick? What is wrong with me? And she said, what did you learn? I said, I learned to be more careful about the people I pick to do a fifth step with. just because all of my other experiences had been good did not mean that I wasn't going to have one that was bad. So what did I learn? You know, everything in my life is a lesson. I've said it several times tonight. I learn from that lesson. I learned to be really, really careful. I am here to tell you now, if I were ready to do a fourth and fifth step, which I probably will do over the summer, there is no way on God's earth that I would go to the priest that I have now, because I've listened and I've observed. And I know that it would not be the freeing experience that I need. This time I would probably pick my sponsor or some other good friend to just sit down and listen to me. So that's the lesson that I learned. I have to learn these lessons. You know, my pride got in my way when I started to do my fourth steps, because, you know, I didn't want to look at me. I didn't want to know what was wrong with me. You know, as long as I could blame all of the outside stuff, I was okay. But as soon as I had to look at the source and I had to own what I had done, it wasn't until I did that and that I told, you know, when I admit it to myself, that's one thing. When I tell it to another human being, somewhere along the line, I can't lie anymore. I have to be honest. And I know that my higher power is constantly there. I know that my higher power is with me at all times. So I know that my higher power knows that I'm doing the very best that I can. I had to learn that with some things. I had a wonderful friend one time when I was going through this agony tell me that, and it was so true, and it certainly has helped me. I've done it in other situations too. It has certainly helped me to understand where my problem is. And many times I give free rent in my head to stuff. You know, I give free rent in my head. Nobody else is particularly worried about it or concerned about it. And yet I am obsessing one more time. And when I'm doing that, then all of those character defects are coming back one more time. You know, my pride is getting in my way. My fear is starting to make me arrogant. I lose my self-confidence, and my selfishness gets in the way one more time, and I just want what I want for me. I have to always look at my past conduct. I have to pray that I don't fall back into those traps. I have to work very hard on it. I'm grateful I have a tenth step, you know, that I can, you know, make my amends when I need to, but I still find that there are things that are so deep down inside of me that I need to sit down and I need to write about it and I need to share it with another human being and I need to free myself so that I can move on in this journey. I'm going to stop. I'm going to end. I'm out of whatever I was going to say. It's 5 minutes before the hour. No souls are saved after the hour. And I know for this alcoholic, if I don't take my sobriety seriously, God will take it away, and he'll give it to someone who will. And I can't afford that. Thanks.